Welcome to everybody. Thank you very much for joining us at this seminar on caste, class and social mobility in Pulanpur by Florian Balazsi. I'm Nick Stern and I'm chair of the LSE's Grantson Research Institute, but this is a seminar of the III, the International Inequalities Institute. So I'm delighted to be able to participate in a seminar of the III. And we have Chico Ferreira, who give us a wave, Chico, who's the director of the III. He's with us, and he's somebody who's been very close to all this work now for something like 35 years. We have Peter Lanyau and Himan Xu, key participants, drivers, leaders of all this. I'm going to show you our book, so that you can see that's the book with Peter and Himanshu and many other participants. The Florian is a postdoc researcher at the Department of Sociology and Social Research at the University of Milano Bicocca, and she's recently defended her thesis on this subject at the University of Paris and the University of Milano. This is a Zoom meeting, so we can see each other, which is all very good, and have an interactive event. Please stay muted, but when we get round to the questions, then we'll have the raise hand function and we'll be able to let you speak. If I could mention two things, upcoming activities of the III. Tomorrow there's a public event called Why is Latin American Inequality So Extreme? And that will host a panel of Latin American experts. And at the same time, we'll launch a new website called the Latin America and Caribbean Inequality Review. So that's from 4 to 5:30 tomorrow. And there'll be a link to the event being posted in the chat. If I could just say, it's Florian who's going to introduce Pulanpur and the background of the work, so I won't do that. But I do want to say how valuable it is for economists like myself and Peter Lanyau and Himanshu and Jean Drez, Christopher Bliss, I mean, most of the people who've been deeply involved in all this have been economists. But right from the beginning, we spoke, Christopher Bliss and I spoke to Scarlett Epstein and André Bataille, two giants of anthropologists, sociologists. They knew a lot of economics as well. And we've tried to stay in close touch, but it is very good for us economists to listen to and be influenced by, educated by sociologists. And that's a special privilege of this seminar today. And we have had, you know, under the leadership of Dinesh Tiwari, anthropologists and sociologists involved, closely involved in the data gathering research work itself. But that's enough from me. Over to you, Florian, to take us through the seminar, Caste, Class and Social Mobility in Pulanpur. Thank you. Thank you very much and welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor Stern. Good morning, everyone. I will just start sharing my screen. So I'm very glad to share with you part of my research on the relationship between caste, class and social mobility. And in particular, we in front of Professor Stern, Himanshu and Lanju, who have a very long history with Pulanpur, that is the village where my research is actually based. So this study contributes to an emerging stream of literature in developing countries and especially in India on intergenerational mobility. In fact, while there is evidence of economic inequality increasing and caste remaining a significant predictor of economic opportunity, there is less research on intergenerational mobility, defined as the effects of inherited advantages and disadvantages on the unequal access to opportunities. However, we believe that in the case of India, studying social mobility defined as the movement between different social classes or groups of occupations corresponding with different socioeconomic status is very relevant because income, which is otherwise used to study mobility, well, in India, information on income are often incomplete or unreliable as the context, the economic context is very much informal, so with irregular forms of work. And moreover, education, which is also another way to study mobility, well, is not very developed in rural areas and is not a strong indicator of different socioeconomic positions, while social class it is. And moreover, social mobility is interesting because historically, the division of labor was intrinsic to the caste hierarchy, and caste used to overlap with class with almost no possibility of individual mobility, especially in agrarian society. However, with the economic diversification, the educational expansion, and the increasing rural-urban connectivity, there is good expectation of social mobility increasing and the link between caste and class to weaken over time. In fact, this is what we should expect according to the modernization theory. So the transition from assigned social position to achieved social position, that is something that has been observed in Western societies. Well, in the literature, there are two contrasting narratives. On one hand, some scholars argue that the effects of caste have weakened over time and the economic development have created new opportunities for social mobility. On the other hand, some scholars advocate for the stickiness of caste. And according to them, caste would remain an important brake on social mobility. However, previous studies have been limited at least for two main reasons. First of all, because of the lack of longitudinal data. In fact, retrospective information has been used, but they are not very often available in terms of occupation. And a second reason is the impossibility to disaggregate the administrative categories of caste, what we commonly call caste, into jati, also called subcaste. The jati, however, is the proper endogamous group to whom each individual is assigned by birth. However, in India, there are maybe more than 6,000 jatis. So of course, large-scale surveys, they do not provide information at the jati level. And instead, the studies interested in caste inequalities, for instance, they use the large administrative categories of caste based on a rough aggregation of all the jatis according to a similar socioeconomic level. And these administrative categories have been introduced by the Nehru government to target socioeconomic disadvantaged groups, especially scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, with policies of quotas. And while at the origin there was a loose correspondence with the Varna classification that ranks people according to different purity level, also reflected in the kind of occupations performed by each of these categories, over the years, the correspondence has lost its significance. In fact, these categories are not stable, as several forward caste from the group of Kshatriya, for instance, they have been incorporated in the other backward classes, which benefit from policies of quotas. And so we believe that it is misleading to use these huge groups of caste to study the association with class, as the definition itself overlaps. Fortunately, Palanpur is an exception to this, as information on jati are available across the 7 surveys, from the first in 1958 to the last in 2015. And moreover, the fact that the whole population has been surveyed 7 times, it makes this village a unique opportunity where to study intergenerational mobility. In fact, we can compare the occupation of father with the occupation of sons at the same stage of their life career, but at different stages over time, over a very long time period. And this time period is characterized by very deep structural transformations from the land reform in the 50s to the Green Revolution in the 70s, and later on the economic liberalization. Well, in Talanpur, there are maybe 10 different jetties, but in this study, we focused only on four of them for their size, and also because they are more representative of the caste system in the region. So at the top, there is the jati of Takur, who historically were the dominant jati in the village. They were warriors, rulers, and landlords. Then we have Moria, who are traditionally self-cultivators, and then Teli and Jatav, who belong from the group of scheduled caste. Teli is a Muslim jati, traditionally oil pressers, but also they are also involved in agriculture as laborers. And finally, Jatav, who were considered as untouchable before, and they have always been the most deprived caste in the village, socially, economically, and also spatially. Look at this map. This is Palanpur, and when I was there in 2018, I geolocalized all the houses in the village and pinpointed them on the map according to their caste. You can observe that while some households from Moria in orange, Teli in green, and Takur in red, they sometimes live in the same neighborhood, Jatavs in light blue are very segregated close to the pond, which is, by the way, considered the most insalubrious area of the village. Well, a few words about the context. Over the whole period, the population has expanded, accounting for almost 1,300 individuals in 2015. And in the very same period, with the demographic pressure over land and the land ownership fragmentation, the cultivable land per household has been decreasing, narrowing down also the inequalities between castes. As a result, and also with the emergence of new occupations, the main activity has shifted from farming to non-farm sectors, such as services, construction, and brick making. However, this shift does not correspond to a complete substitution of agriculture, but it mainly corresponds to a situation where individuals multiply the sources of livelihood, and cultivation has become a secondary activity oriented to self-consumption and playing also an important role of backup for food security, because periods of unemployment and uncertainty are very frequent in this context. Think about the pandemic crisis, for instance. Having some land and sustain the households for food consumption can make a big difference. But apart from this extreme case, unemployment is very frequent in this context because most of the non-farm jobs available are informal and casual in nature, so irregular. Well, with all these changes, previous studies by Professor Stern, Himanshu, and Lanju showed that poverty has declined, first with green revolution and then with non-farm wages, and inequality has increased, but within jati more than between jatis, suggesting that new opportunities opened up to all jatis, but that conditions of access to these opportunities are not equal to all individuals. And this is exactly what we aim to investigate with this study, whether the social fluidity has increased in terms of relative chances to access better opportunities, and whether the influence of jati on social mobility has decreased. So we adopt a mixed method approach, combining surveys from the seven waves that have been carried out with 6 months of fieldwork that we spent in Palanpur and also in states where most of the migrants from Palanpur used to go. We carried out 100 semi-structured interviews and also a genealogical survey among 130 households to fill survey discrepancies and missing intergenerational links. First of all, in order to study social mobility, we needed to define a class schema. And for the conceptualization of class in Palanpur, we refer to the standard EGP class schema used in Western society studies of social mobility, which engage theoretically with the Weberian idea that members of the same class should have a comparable socioeconomic position or similar life chances determined by similar income level, ownership, degree of autonomy, job regularity, level of skills, employment relations, etc. And in this context, we do not have detailed information at each survey on all of these aspects, but we triangulate the survey's data with interviews and observations in order to define relevant social classes. So we define seven different classes along two dimensions. The first one is the sector of activity, whether it's farming or not. In the case of agrarian classes, we distinguish large farmers from middle farmers and agricultural laborers according to the land ownership or tenancy and the size of the land holding. While among non-farm occupations, we distinguish the regular forms of employment, such as high salariat, which in this context correspond to teachers, doctors, compounders, etc., from low salariat, which corresponds to railway technicians, guards, peons, etc. And finally, we distinguish self-employed, which corresponds to artisans and petty business, from manual workers who are unskilled daily casual workers. The second dimension is the hierarchical one. In fact, in order to study vertical mobility, we use an aggregated version of the class schema where we grouped large farmers and high salariat in the top class, middle farmers, low salariat, self-employed in the middle class, and agricultural laborers and manual workers in the low class. And the hierarchical dimension is supported by a certain idea of prestige that emerges from the vernacular categories of occupations that villagers use to distinguish different groups of occupations. In particular, three systematic terms of comparison emerge from the interviews. The first term of comparison is the regularity of employment. People commonly distinguish wage regular employment from majduri, who are casual manual workers. And wage regular employment is often considered more prestigious due to the regularity, but also because the kind of work done by regular employee is involving cognitive tasks rather than hard, back-breaking menial jobs. And finally, we found a residual notion of purity in the distinction between what people call clean work, so the kind of jobs performed in the inside space, very much more prestigious than what they call dirty work, so manual jobs performed in the outside involving dust and sunburn and commonly used to denote bricking workers or porters. Now, the analytical strategy. The analytical strategy consists in measuring the intergenerational mobility, distinguishing absolute mobility from relative mobility. Absolute mobility measures the total movements between the classes of origins and the classes of destination, while relative mobility measures the relative chances of being in a class of destination rather than another according to the class of origin. Then we study also the influence of other factors and in particular the Jati class association over time and the influence that has on social mobility. We study outflow rates, odds ratio, we analyze the interviews and we estimate different logistic regressions to take into account a series of factors and at the individual and the household level. The analysis is restricted to males as women in rural areas used to leave their village after marriage to join their in-law villages. And so there is no possibility to do an intergenerational follow-up of the adult women living in Palanpur. Among males, we managed to pair up to 75% of all individuals with their father, which in half of the case corresponds to a match with both fathers and grandfathers. In order to compare the class of fathers and sons, but at a similar stage of their professional career, we select the occupation surveyed for the first time, which corresponds on average at the age of 26 years old, and which we consider as a good enough indicator of the occupational maturity, which in Western society is later in life, but in this context, the participation to work starts earlier. And moreover, we know that the occupation that an individual has at the moment of marriage is very determinant for the marriage alliances. And in this village, the average age at marriage is 22. So we consider that at 26, the occupation performed by an individual is a good indicator of his socioeconomic position. We decompose the population by birth cohorts to compare different periods relevant for the analysis. So those born before 1956, those born between 56 and 75, and those born after 75. Now, results. The first thing we look at are outflows from origins to destinations across the three cohorts using mobility matrices. We can notice two main things. In the first cohort, the table is very sparse. There are a lot of structural zeros as the occupational structure was much simpler during the agrarian society, and classes were indeed mainly agrarian. Second, we notice that immobility, or the fact that sons follow their father's occupation on the diagonal cells, has decreased over time. Look at large farmers in particular. In the first cohort, 73% of sons of large farmers remain in the same class, while in the second cohort, they fell down to 35%, and in the third cohort to 15%. Most of the large farmers, they moved to middle farmers and also to the class of manual workers that, if you look at the third cohort, you can see that became the class that absorbed the most of the outflows from agrarian classes. We also observe some upward movement from the low class of agricultural laborers to middle class position in the second cohort, but in the third cohort, the movement toward the class of manual workers prevails. And in order to ensure that the movements toward manual workers are not biased by a life cycle effect, as it could be that people at a very early stage of their career, they enter manual workers, but then they move on. But unfortunately, it's not the case, as intergenerational immobility prevails for manual workers. So to sum up the trends that emerge from the mobility tables, we can say that total mobility has increased from less than 30% to 80% in the third cohort, but it has been mainly downward, suggesting that actually there is no room for people exiting agriculture among top class. And in fact, if we look at the occupational structure by year, it is very clear how high salariate has not compensated for the contraction of large farmers. Look at high salariate, is the pink share, and it never absorbs more than 5% of the working population, while large farmers in orange has decreased dramatically over time. And both high and low salariate, so the regular forms of employment, after a period of expansion in the 70s and the 80s, they shrink in favor of self-employment and manual workers. In this picture, migration attrition could partly contribute to a downward mobility trend, as there can be a negative selection of those left behind in the village. However, we know that migration only concerns a marginal share of the population, as commuting prevail over migration. And moreover, while there is evidence of outside non-farm jobs being often regular employment before the 90s, in the subsequent years, it is less certain whether migration is related to better social positions. So globally, the analysis of the absolute mobility informed us about the availability of opportunities for upward mobility, that in this case are very limited, and it's something that actually it has been acknowledged also in other parts of India. But now what we are really interested in is the second question, which concerns the relative chances that individuals from different origins have to access these opportunities, irrespective of the changes in the occupational structure. So in order to test whether the relative mobility has increased over time, or in other words, whether the influence of the origins on the destinations have decreased, we fit different log linear models. The logic here is to define the most parsimonious models that describe at best the observed patterns of associations between origins, destinations, and birth cohorts, which is a time effect, let's say. We want to test whether these patterns of association that lie behind the mobility tables we saw before are reflected by some models where we put constraints on the specification. In the first model, we postulate that the class of destination would be influenced neither by the class of origin nor by the period effect. That in this case is the birth cohort. In the second model, we posit that origins and destinations are independent within each other and only the occupational distribution change, that is the probability of being in a class of destination or another, is only affected by the structural changes. And finally, in the third model, we test the hypothesis of the association between origins and destinations remaining stable over time. But we reject these three hypotheses as none of these models explain well the observed frequencies. And this means to us that there has been some changes over time in terms of relative mobility. And in fact, this is something that we confirm with the last two models, where we test more specifically whether the intergenerational inheritance has changed over time. And because we obtain a good fit, it means that the influence of origin on destination has decreased over time, especially in terms of immobility. And the fit improves even more in the fifth model when we assume that immobility decreases, but at a different pace for different classes, which means that some classes of origins have maintained some advantages over others for immobility, so social reproduction. So let's see how is the structures of advantages. In this graph, you can see the generalized odds ratio reported for cohort one in the lighter circle, cohort two in orange, and cohort three in red. The generalized odds ratio are a synthetic measure commonly used in mobility studies to indicate the degree of relative advantages and disadvantages that individuals from different social origins have relative to others. In fact, odds ratio are thought to be a good measure of the relative mobility as they are insensitive to changes in the total distribution. So in this case, you can see odds ratio value more than one, which means that we show only relative advantages. And we can see that the advantage of large farmers for remaining in the same class has declined over time, but they still have an advantage for remaining in the top class. In fact, they have an advantage for moving to high salariate, and sons of high salariate are advantaged for remaining in the top class. While at the bottom, the advantage for immobility, which in this case, we should talk about disadvantage, but you can see that agricultural laborers are more likely to remain agricultural laborers. And similarly, we can see that there is also an advantage for manual workers to be manual workers or to move to agricultural laborers. So in any case, to remain in the low class. So globally, the structure of advantages has become very polarized among the top and the low class, which is also reflected here in the structure of disadvantages. In fact, by mirror, you can see that there is a strong and growing disadvantage of sons of low class and middle class to move upwardly into middle and upper classes, and a disadvantage of upper classes to move to low classes. Now, let's move beyond and behind social origin. What is the meaning of the mediating role of the jati? Is the jati reinforcing the association between social origin and destination? So from the interviews, it appeared that occupational preferences of dominant jatis are still influenced by ritual norms to protect their status from negative stigma. As Manish, who is a Moriya guy, age 36, explains very well. So he says, working in bricklayers is dependent on the jati. People choose a profession according to their, see, the five fingers of the hand are not equal. And Ramesh, in a very pejorative way, says only chamars, talking about jatavs, can do this work, brickmaking, because they are inferior jatis, while thakurs must earn out of their ideas, not their body. And that is why thakurs are forward. What we observed with the transition out of the agrarian society and so the emergence of new occupations, we observed that the ritual status is reproducing the distinction between salaried employment, considered as prestigious, and casual manual work. And this at the risk of pauperization of dominant jatis. In fact, Rampal explains, taking the example of road cleaning, he says, a person from a superior jati will never agree to do this job, even if you offer 1,000 rupees for doing it. On the other hand, if there is an office-based work, a good work, he will be happy to work even at a wage of 4 rupees, but he can't be happy at 1,000 rupees in an inferior job, because it defames his status and therefore we call it inferior job. So really the question of the honor and the fact that people from a superior jati do not want to dishonor their community by performing unprestigious jobs, it is something that we observed in all the interviews. And to the point that even families who have lost their economic advantage because land is reducing, agriculture is less rewarding, they continue to prevent women to take part to economic activity because among thakurs, it is a factor it is something that defames the reputation, and it is what Lakshmi said. As a result, we found an increasing trade-off between the ritual and the economic dimensions in the reproduction of the status, at the expense of thakurs, apparently, as many complained to us. In fact, you can see that Sunni from the Moria community says, casual manual wages are relatively higher than some regular employment. Superior jatis are lagging behind. This is the effect. No matter how much land they own, the thing is that thakurs don't want to take up inferior jobs. And as a result, Chaman Kumar, who is a thakur, says the means of livelihood available to thakurs are less because thakurs can't work in activities of the kind that inferior jatis can do, because we have to sustain living, but also honor should not be compromised. So, this narrative suggests that the probability of taking an opportunity rather than another is influenced by collective dynamics and social norms at the jati level, and so that social mobility is influenced by the jati. And this is something that we tried to verify quantitatively by estimating the influence that the jati has on the probability of experiencing social mobility over time. So look here. We ran a multi-logic model where we estimate the probability of an individual to attain a socioeconomic position corresponding to the top, the middle, or the low class. We control for the class of the father, which is the social origin, the jati, and the interaction between the two. And we also control for the life cycle effects and the time period effects, including age and birth cohort. We control for some individual characteristics like education, marital status, and also other household characteristics like the size of the household and the birth ranking of the individual. In fact, we found that the agency within the household differs for eldest son, so that's why we also included this control. And now look at the results. Here you can see the average marginal effect of the jati on the probability of being in the top class, in the middle class, and in the low class. The effects are reported as percentage points of difference in the probability of ending up in each of these three groups of classes with respect to thakurs probability on the zero line and all other things being equal. Birth cohorts are ordered on the x-axis from the eldest cohort to the youngest cohort, and the effects are plotted by class of origin. So blue line corresponds to those individuals having origins in the top class, red line in the middle class, and the green line in the low class. on the left side graph, we see that JATAVs and TALEs, so the bottom, the so-called inferior JATIs by the villagers, we can see that their disadvantage for attaining the top class has decreased over time with respect to TACURS, as the percentage points of differences have reduced from around 50 points less probabilities in the first cohort to almost zero, with some differences according to the class of origin. However, we know that the probabilities of being in the top class have structurally decreased over time, with also less chances for TACURS to remain actually into the class of large farmers or to move to the class of high salariates. So it is a decrease in the disadvantage, but a fictive one, because opportunities of upward mobility are actually very limited. Now, the central graph displays the probability of being in the middle class, and we can see that Moria's probability has become closer to TACURS 1, while for JATAVs and TAS and TELI, so the Maslim JATI, the trend is the opposite, as they lost their advantage, and from the second cohort onward, they are really less likely than TACURS to be in the low class, with not many differences according to the class of origin. This is in the case of JATAVs, while for TELI you can see that those having origins in low class, they are still even more disadvantaged. Now, in the third graph on the right side, we clearly observe that JATAVs and TELI are increasingly likely to end up in the low class compared to TACURS, whatever origins they have. So you can see that their disadvantage has increased for both JATAVs and TELIs. So, but okay, so we can see from this result that the JATI effect has remained over time, and that the disadvantage of lower JATIs have increased over time compared to TACURS to remain or to move to low class. However, the narratives that we collected push us to put some nuance on our conclusions, because rather than just a story of total immiseration, the trade-off I was talking about before between the ritual and the economic dimensions that emerges with the economic diversification and the rise of non-farm wages, we observe that there is a common perception of declassment of the dominant JATIs and empowerment of the lower JATIs. In fact, this trade-off is at the expense of the dominant JATIs. And this appears very clear in this narrative I reported here from Nane, a TELI man, who says, TACURS think that working in manual jobs is a shame and it does not fit their status. These TACURS smell bad because they don't even take bath every day, their clothes are not clean, and yet they call themselves TACURS. In order to wash the clothes, you need money, and for money, you need to work. So you can see there is a residual of this idea of purity associated with the status, but because of this perception of declassment, also the ritual status of dominant JATI is under threat. And Bablu, a young man from the JATAV community, says, we JATAVs have always been majduri, so manual workers, but now we are not dependent on them, TACURS, anymore, because they work outside and the employment relations, even though they have not maybe changed in nature, but inferior JATI used to work for the dominant JATIs in their land before, and now it has changed. And he says, I am still poor, but I work hard and I will improve the future of my child. So there are also other factors, of course, in this story. Secondary education is positively associated with the probability of being high salariate. However, education is limited. Moreover, we know that it's correlated with JATI, is not insensitive to economic inequalities, and it will probably become worse because there is an increasing demand for private school, as public school is very low in quality. And also we know that aspirations and willingness to invest into education is somehow limited because contacts, networks, and inducements seem to play a major role in entering government jobs, which is the maximum aspirations of people who are willing to follow education. And there are also plenty of other factors that we highlighted, especially in the interviews, like the effects of networks. We know that recruitment in factories is highly determined by networks, and there is a logic among placement agencies for hiring migrants from different places in order to keep, because as they say, that taking a large group from the same plastic, from the same place is risky because all of them tend to go back together to village during festivals or harvesting. So they prefer to hire people from different places, and they rely on a complex chain of subcontracting, which also which is also influenced by community and caste mechanisms. Then the poor reliability of trains also limit the possibility to commute and work in closer factories, especially in the industrial cluster of Moradabad, which is 30 kilometers away. This is very strange because very few wage workers from Palanpur go to work in the industrial cluster of Moradabad, while factory works are quite quite researched. But instead, they go to very farther places, and this is because of network, but it is also because it is also motivated by a wage differential, the fact that outside women, that outside the village, women can also work, reputation is not a problem there. And yeah, as I say, the poor reliability of trains is a major problem too. And also the absence of formal vocational training. It's a problem for manual workers to become self-employed, so a barrier to social mobility, because skilled artisans, on one hand, they fear for future competitors, so they are reluctant to share their knowledge, and on the other hand, learning from a master requires a long period of apprenticeship, poorly paid, and apprentices must show devotion and respect to their master. So here again, there is also a jati effect behind and other factors. But I will quickly go to the conclusions in order to keep some time for the discussion. So to sum up, social fluidity has increased net of structural changes, but opportunities for upward mobility are limited. After the Green Revolution, we saw that there was a general trend of downward mobility of agrarian classes. And we saw, in terms of relative mobility, we saw that the hereditary effect is more persistent among top class, as sons of large farmers and high salaries are more likely to be in the top class than others. And there is a strong class disadvantage of manual workers and agricultural laborers of experiencing upward mobility compared to others. We saw that there is a persistent jati effect, and especially a jati disadvantage for lower jatis, who are less likely to experience upward mobility over time due to the jati effect. However, with the increasing trade-off between the ritual and the economic dimensions of the status, lower jatis empower themselves on the dominant jatis, at least in the perception. And other factors like poor public education and absence of formal vocational training act also like bonds to upward social mobility. So this is all for me.
All very clear, Florianne. Thank you. Thank you so much. There are, I can see two raised hands. I think I can see. Aluna Glucksberg, Shabi Anwar and Eugene Kulas. Could we take them in that order? And I'll ask you to ask the questions in sequence, and then Florian can come back on all three. So Luna Glucksberg, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Brilliant. Thank you. I want to thank the speaker. Very, very interesting talk. I suppose my question comes from my background in elite studies and social mobility. And I think often you find this tension between elites that sort of come down in the class hierarchy because of not being able to engage with certain kinds of work, and lower classes that move up because they can. And usually that is solved through marriage. which may go against tradition, but that is how this conflict is often solved and how the classes ally one another, ally with each other. And so you have both money and status. And so I was wondering if I could ask something about marriage patterns and how that's developing and if it has any impact.
Thank you very much, Luna. Shabi, Anwar, could you ask your question, please?
Yeah, thank you, Florian. Thank you so much for the presentation. I work in the Department of Dalit Studies in Indian Social Institute, and my area of interest is discrimination and exclusion, mostly of children. In recent 11-state study, what we have found, so our study was for the team, for the group in engaged in unclean occupation, generally the Safai Karmcharis and manual scavengers. So although the government says that manual scavenging doesn't exist anymore, but it does. So anyways, in our study, what we, so there has been a contractualization of Safai Karmchari in India, and especially in the urban areas. What trend we have seen is that people from OBCs and even from the from the scheduled castes, the upper caste categories who were traditionally not involved in manual scavenging or unclean occupation, they tend to fight for these contracts jobs, because the unemployment what persists here, and then. Of course, they do not work. They sublet the job to the lowermost caste groups. Now, considering this trend, do you think that higher caste groups are in because of unemployment are ready to compromise with the caste, with the mindset of caste in them, and what implication it has in changing mindset with regard to caste?
Thank you very much, Shabi. And Eugene Kulas, please.
Hello, I could hear the speakers speaking about high caste and low caste and dominant caste and the opposite. But can the academia academia is committed to develop a liberty or equality terminology? Terminology is very important in the liberation of people. And if academia continue to go on saying that the high caste and low caste, that itself is giving inferiority complex to the poor people. And psychologically they are affected. It creates mental health problem. It's high time that the academia, look into their terminologies to describe the caste situation. And secondly, in UK, there is an Equality Act in which caste discrimination is included as a protect, I mean, not discrimination, caste is included as a protective characteristics, and that has to be implemented. And how intelligentsia, especially academia, can take up this challenge to implement this particular provision in the Equality Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eugene. So three questions, Florian. Would you like to respond, please?
Thank you for your questions. I'll start from the last question about terminology and the performative effects of the terminology used either in surveys or by scholars in the studies. Well, I do agree with you, but I tried at the maximum to stick to what emerged from the narratives I collected. And really, I can promise you that people, both from what I used to call lower jatis and higher jatis, they do distinguish themselves from the others, relying on this kind of hierarchy. And I in my interviews, I asked to all the villagers how they perceive this hierarchy. We did have some discussions on this, And they, it is very much part of their perception of the society, and they place themselves in a hierarchy. So I think that it is something that exists. It's a social fact, and we must take into account this, even though politically we want to fight against it, but it's a matter of fact. So now the question on mindset of upper caste, how to answer this question? Well, I don't know. I was in Palanpur in 2018, and you can see from the narratives I choose, which are very representative of the kind of narratives I collected as a whole, you can see that really Thakurs are very much concerned about their economic status, and actually they have some advantages over other groups. So they are still quite advantaged, and they have a better access to regular employment and better social positions. But I think that really they are not ready to go for manual jobs, even though they could earn better, if these manual jobs are linked to the Jatav community, so the low Jatis community. Because some of them who are very poor, they do work as porters, for instance, which is also a casual manual work, which is also a manual work. But not a lot of Jatavs do this job. So there is still a very clear occupational segregation at the Jati level. And they really try to distinguish themselves, either going for regular jobs at a lower wage, or to work as casual manual workers, but in sectors where Jatavs are not the majority. And finally, the question on marriages. Yeah, that's true. And there is a huge literature on this in Western societies. But in India, you must take into account that inter-caste marriages, it's really a minority, and probably even more in rural areas. So I think that it does not give a lot of space for strategies of status mobility, because people from the same Jatis marry within the same Jati. So they are, well, one limit of this study in Palanpur is that we cannot generalize, okay, even though there are other village studies, and we know that there are many points in common. But at least in Palanpur, we know that people from the Thakurs community, they will marry with the Thakurs community, and they face the same kind of problems. So yeah, I think that marriage is not a way to solve this declassment phenomena.
Thank you very much, Florian. Eleanor, you've got a question?
Yes, hi, thanks for a really interesting talk. I think my question picks up a little bit on an aspect of Luna's question there, which, though maybe I'm framing it slightly differently, which has to do about sort of sampling decisions that you inevitably have to make with this work. So you mentioned briefly, for example, the possibility of a selection effect with those who have moved out of the community, potentially having that have been, you know, not just outward mobility, but also upward mobility, and you gave an explanation for why that might not be the case. But I'm also wondering if you can speak to your impression of what the consequence of having to focus on men because of patrilocal residence does for the conclusions that you're drawing here. So if you had had women in focus and were able to look at their mobility and the mobility of women through here, if you think that would be changing your story in any particular way, for example, to focus on education or different types of labor opportunities. Thanks.
Florian, if I could ask the last question, if you could take Eleanor's question and mine together. If you think about cohort four, because we'll be back in Palanpur, yeah? So cast your mind to the future. And this is something we've done in the past. How would you speculate on some of your conclusions? Would, for example, the big expansion of education make much difference to what happens next? Now, we heard the testimony of the chap who said he'd got his son educated, but he still couldn't afford the bribe to get him a job. That's one perspective. But running it forward, where do you think it might go? Because as we go into cohort four, having hypotheses would be a good idea. So if you could take Eleanor's question and my question, that will be the last ones.
Yeah, thank you both for your questions, because it gives me the opportunity also to talk about two important aspects that I have not focused on in this presentation. So considering the contribution of women to the to work, well, in Palanpur, but also in India in general, there is a problem of invisibilization of women work, because women do work a lot. They work, first of all, in fields, so they work in agriculture, but I also do work in other sectors. This is more the case of women from lower jatis, as I said, and especially those who migrate out, because they are less concerned by reputation effects. But in fact, they do work. But there is a problem, because they tend to hide this because of the social norm imposed by higher jatis. There is this belief of women working outside being a very bad thing that has a negative effect on marriage alliances, for instance. So they are very much concerned in the image that they gave to the society. So women tend to undervalue and underreport their participation to work. So this is a problem, apart from the fact that the intergenerational follow-up is limited by the fact that women move out. So in Palanpur, there has been a survey conducted in 2010 on women, and we observe that in fact women do work more than what we could expect. But there is no systematic information on occupation. So the possibility to investigate on it was limited. However, in my narratives, in the interviews, I also asked a lot of women how they perceive this status, how they perceive the status, and how they, for instance, they talked a lot about the fights with other families, and they are very much concerned about the reputation of their households and their communities. So they are very actively involved in reproducing the status. And this appeared even as
Florian, we're more.
Oh, yes.
And please, you don't have to answer my question. We can do that offline, and we can.
But maybe just in 1 minute, I will say that yes, education is expanding, and we found a positive association between high salary positions and education. So the main problem here is, where are the opportunities? And this is a problem for the economic development of India, because the large share of the rural population finds no room to escape from the agrarian distress. And so it's more a problem of the kind of opportunities they can access to, more than the advancement of education, I think, or both. Both things must be taken into account.
Thank you very much, Florian. Let's try to develop some expectations about the future, and we'll write that into the research applications for the next round. Thank you, Florian. It was a tremendous talk. I learned a lot, and I know something about Palanpur, and I'm sure that those listening learned a lot as well, and some very, very thoughtful questions. So thank you. That's really a tremendous piece of work, and something that I hope very much will continue. Thank you to the III for hosting us, and to all the team that's been involved, in Nina Lonkar and all the team involved in making this happen. Thank you, Chico, for being with us today. And if you'd like to know more about LSE's International Inequalities Institute, the III, please follow the link on the chat function. There's lots going on, and I'm sure you enjoy it. But most of all, Florian, thank you very much again. And thank you all to III, at III, for helping to make this happen. So goodbye.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Bye.